Welcome. Today we are welcoming Dr. Catherine Smart, who is the president of the Canadian Medical Association. You, Connor, we're very pleased that you're in such a prestigious role and you get to share the voice of the Yukon. We're doing this on youth vaccination. We're having a little Q&A today about youth vaccination. My name is Medea Alatini, and I'm zooming in from Kwanlin Yu, so Whitehorse, Yukon, the traditional territory of the Kwanlin Dun First Nation and the Ta'an-Quechan Council. So welcome, Dr. Smart. Love that name.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Can you just give a little background, your history before becoming the president of the CMA?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been living in the Yukon now for 4 years. So I moved here with my family to start and expand the pediatrics program in the Yukon 4 years ago. And it's been really exciting place to live and incredible people to meet and work with. And we've been able to expand our program to 3 full-time pediatricians. We have outreach now to all the communities. We're able to work with CYFN to do some clinics at the cultural center in town regularly as well. So it's been just a fantastic place to live and raise my own kids. And it's been just amazing all the different community partners we've been able to work with. And I'm quite proud of our program. And I think really the ability to expand and reach more kids that need more services. So I'm certainly grateful to call the Yukon home.
Sheesh, thank you. Because, and I've heard some really good things about the outreach that's being done with families and children, knowing that if we improve these health outcomes of children now, that can have a lasting impact on their futures. So really
Yes, absolutely.
extending our appreciation there. I want to jump right in and talk about the availability of vaccines, so the COVID-19 vaccine. Specifically, the Pfizer vaccine that's going to be available for youth. And just for you to share your thoughts and your opinions about the availability of the youth vaccine for 5 to 11 year olds.
Yeah, I'm really excited that I think quite soon the vaccine's going to be available to youth in Yukon and across Canada. Very soon COVID's going to be a vaccine preventable illness in children, like many other of the illnesses that used to really worry us for kids that now are very rare because of vaccination. And once we have vaccine available to all age groups, that's going to make a huge difference. I think all of us are aware of, we're just seeing those numbers in schools really tick up here over the last few weeks. Really concerning for parents and also really disruptive just to people's lives, to have your child potentially be sick and worried about them, or to have your child as a contact of someone else who was sick. And once we can have children immunized, these things are going to become much less common. And I think it's going to really provide a lot of peace for families that just don't have to worry about that as much moving forward. So it's going to be a huge advantage for our community.
That is, and we know, so last night, Yukon declared a state of emergency, and part of it is we're seeing a lot of cases in schools. What's the most compelling reason for parents to have their child vaccinated with the COVID-19 vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's, several reasons. So I'll kind of maybe break them down. I think first and foremost, there has to be a benefit to the child as an individual. And it's quite clear that that's the case. So we know, fortunately, COVID doesn't tend to make children as sick as perhaps elders, but it can be a significant illness in children. About 1 in 100 kids who get COVID may end up needing care in hospital. And of those children who end up in hospital, about 30% of those will need intensive care, which means they're, critically ill. So it's not a non-serious disease in children, despite what some people would like to say. So that's the first and foremost, is that can be prevented. Those outcomes can be prevented with vaccination. Then we have, sort of stage two, if you got infected with COVID, which is the risk for long COVID, which I think we'll talk about in more detail later. And then there's also this condition called multi-inflammatory systems condition, which is, acute, very significant inflammation throughout the body that affects organs and blood vessels. And that makes children actually very, very sick. And that happens in about 1 in 3,000 children who have had COVID. So there's sort of like the medical benefits individually to the child is preventing the risk of those outcomes, which is significant. Then there's all the other issues. going to school, we all know that's super important that kids can go to school and not have their education disrupted. We already had, you know, some disruption last year, and now we're seeing more disruption with kids having to be home isolating or isolated because of contacts in their classroom. So being able to make that less common for kids, I think, is super important. Kids getting back to the rest of their normal lives, extracurricular activities, fun with friends and family, being able to visit perhaps vulnerable family members, elders, other people in the family who may have medical conditions that make them more vulnerable to COVID. These are things that some families have had to avoid now for a long time, which is, you know, obviously has a huge, huge impact. And then just the disruption and stress on the family when they're worried about their child being sick or their child is sick, and how that rolls out. So those things are all huge as well. And then there's the broader benefit to the community, which would be making community spread less likely as more people in the Yukon are immunized. So those are kind of, to me, the levels of protection. It starts with that individual benefit to the child, then the family, and then the community, and vaccination of children will give all those benefits.
Thank you. And I think that's always a concern for First Nation communities is how do we protect our community? And when we think of the whole premise behind our self-government agreements and everything is together today for our children tomorrow. And today is the day that we're protecting our children.
Absolutely.
Can we delve into the safety and the approval process for the Pfizer vaccine for pediatrics?
Yes, that's such an important question. And I think, you know, for most parents, when they're making a health decision around or for their child, that's really what they want to know, you know, is this safe? So what do we know so far? You know, we know the vaccine's been improved in kids 12 to 17, and we've seen large rollout of, you know, hundreds of thousands of children in Canada that age receiving the vaccine and millions of children around the world. And it's largely proven safe. There's been some concern around myocarditis, particularly in adolescent boys. But that risk is still much lower than the risk of getting myocarditis from COVID itself. So still in terms of a risk-benefit ratio, it's quite clear the vaccine still is advantageous versus just, you know, taking your chances with getting COVID. Also, many, many hospitalizations prevented, and those cases of myocarditis have generally been very mild and self-limited. Now, of course, we're wondering what about younger children? So the trial that was done by Pfizer had just over 3,000 kids. And really what it was asking was the question, do we get an adequate immune response in children from the vaccine? And what they did is they used a lower dose than what was used in adults and teenagers. So it was instead of 30 micrograms of the vaccine, it was 10 micrograms. And the reason for that was we know children's immune responses are generally a bit more robust than what we see in older youth and adults. That's why, you know, when your kid gets a runny nose and a sore throat, they get a high fever and you likely don't as an adult. Their immune systems are just a bit more vigorous in that way. So their theory was that they thought they would likely see a very good immune response to the vaccine with a lower dose. And that's what the study showed us. So that data on those 3,000 kids showed that with that 10 microgram dose, they showed excellent immune response, very comparable to the larger dose of the vaccine we used in older kids and adults. So it seems robust. And that's why we feel that most likely it's going to be approved and we're going to be able to move forward with immunizing kids 5 to 11.
And I want to stress or pick up on a point that you made around myocarditis. Mm-hmm. So that has been talked about a lot, especially since the 12 to 17 year old approval was issued. You said people would get myocarditis or they do have a risk of getting myocarditis with contracting COVID.
That's right. So maybe let me explain that in a bit more detail. I agree with you. I think it's an important thing for parents to understand because it is definitely the biggest risk of the vaccine appears to be myocarditis. But again, it's rare and it tends to be more in boys and boys that are in adolescence. So it's older teenagers, young men. That's the age group where we've seen the highest prevalence. Quite rare in girls. But also still rare in boys of that age. And the risk from getting myocarditis from COVID itself is 6 times higher than from the vaccination. So I think that's important to understand. And with the Delta variant, it is so contagious that really our expectation is that anyone who's not vaccinated is likely at some point to get COVID. It just doesn't seem really avoidable at this point, the way it's spreading through communities. So it's going to be a difficult thing to avoid altogether. And that's why in the risk balance, it does seem safer to be immunized. And then of course, also important is understanding for those people that did get myocarditis from the vaccine, you know, how serious was it? Because that's also important. And the vast majority of people who had that side effect, it was very mild and self-limited, meaning they didn't require hospitalization. And most people were treated with over-the-counter medications like Advil or Motrin, an anti-inflammatory, for a few days while things settled down. So again, you know, yes, a small risk, but much less than what we're actually seeing from COVID, and largely something that's been self-limited. Now, the other thing I might add on to that, you know, and then people might be thinking, okay, then what's the risk in 5 to 11 for myocarditis? And what I would say about that is there were no cases of myocarditis in the study that was done by Pfizer. However, the study wasn't powered to find that side effect, meaning there wasn't enough children in the study to detect that, because to find something that rare, you'd have to have hundreds of thousands of children in the study. So it's not really a practical study design. That's why post-vaccine surveillance is so important, so that we can pick up on these signals and understand them better as something's rolled out more broadly in the community. And that's how we were able to better understand the risk of myocarditis in youth and young adults, is as it's been distributed through the population. We've seen that side effect, we've learned more about it, and we've been able to compare it to your baseline risk from COVID itself. Now, people theoretically think the risk will likely be much lower in kids 5 to 11, primarily because we haven't seen a lot of cases in that younger end of the spectrum, in that 12 to 17 cohort. So the expectation is likely even less in younger children, and sort of for two reasons. One is there's a reason, or scientists are sort of feeling that likely testosterone has a role to play in that reaction to the vaccine. And that's likely why we're seeing it in older teenage boys and young adult men. And obviously we're not seeing that in younger kids because they're not yet in puberty. But the other difference being the smaller dose of the vaccine, we think will make the risk somewhat less. And the reason we think that is there were slightly more cases of myocarditis with Moderna than with Pfizer. And the Moderna vaccine, the dose is higher. So there's some feeling that even the lower dose of Pfizer now that we'll be giving to younger children will likely make that side effect less likely. But we'll know more when we have more children that have been immunized. But I think at this point, there's not a lot of reason to think there'll be a substantial or increased risk in that age group than what we've seen already.
Mm-hmm. Besides myocarditis, is there any other risks that the 5 to 11 age group would be experiencing? Mm-hmm. Anything else that came out?
Yeah, the other side effects are really very similar to what we see with all vaccines, which are sort of local and systemic side effects. So most common being a sore arm or redness at the site of immunization, which is very common with all the vaccines. And then the more systemic side effects being just a general feeling of not being well. So sometimes fever, which is a sign that our immune system is responding to the vaccine, headache, fatigue, those sort of just generalized, I don't feel well type symptoms. Some people have experiencing those over the first 24 to 48 hours, but again, actually at a lower incidence in these younger children than what we've been seeing in youth and adults.
So is the recommendation before you're going to get your vaccine? I know all my kids received all of their childhood immunities, and yeah, I just gave them a child Tylenol before the shots. Is that something that pediatrics are recommending?
I don't think that people need to do it ahead of the vaccine, because a lot of kids won't even get those side effects, but I'd absolutely have it on hand. And if your child develops some fever or isn't feeling well, you know, headaches, muscle aches, something like that, then absolutely very safe to give them some Tylenol or Advil to treat those symptoms if they occurred.
Okay, awesome. Around the effectiveness of the vaccine, actually, before I get to that, could you highlight the approval process, how this went through?
Yes, for sure.
And maybe the approval level that we're going to see.
Yeah. So basically what happens is the trial was done by Pfizer. They then submit the data. So they submitted it first to the FDA in the United States, then soon after to Health Canada, which is why our approval is lagging a bit behind the United States. So probably a lot of people are aware that it received unanimous approval by the FDA in the States. So now it's in front of Health Canada. So what happens there is the scientists at Health Canada review all the data from Pfizer and make a determination of whether or not they think the vaccine is safe and effective. Then once approved, which is what we're anticipating based on what we already know from the data, then once Health Canada has approved the vaccine, it then the data moves on to the NACI, which will then give the recommendations about how that vaccine would be utilized in Canada. So that would be things like, you know, what's the interval between the doses? Are they recommending, you know, 28 days? Are they recommending a bit longer? You know, those types of things. So that's sort of the levels that it goes through. And then from that point on, of course, then there's the very robust vaccine, post-vaccine surveillance, where we start, you know, gathering data about what's happening and monitoring for any signals of things like myocarditis as an example. And then that information is fed back to those groups who can. You're muted right now. I've lost you.
Oh, darn it. I was saying we had internet. I'm babbling away. Internet
Sorry.
Technicalities. That's all good. I understand that the pediatric vaccine is going through the full approval process. Could you differentiate that, what that means?
Yeah, so I think that's been another thing that's been a bit confusing to people about the vaccine. You'll hear a lot of anti-vaxxers sort of using this rhetoric, oh, it's an experimental vaccine. It's not fully approved. And that's not accurate. It is actually fully approved by Health Canada. It's not experimental. And we're anticipating that same full approval for the pediatric vaccine as well.
Okay. Yeah. So full approval. That's like
right. Yeah.
It's going through all the rigors of every
all
other
the rigors.
That-
yeah. That's right. Okay. And it is a very rigorous process. And that's why, you know, we know they've had the data now for a few weeks. That's why it's not sort of something that happens overnight, is they do take this process very seriously. There's a lot of different scientists that look at the data. So it's not, you know, a quick thing. They want to make sure that the process is rigorous. And that's why we haven't, I think, heard yet, is it's going through all their processes. So yes, it's being, you know, prioritized, but there's no shortcuts that are happening. So I think that's what's important for people to understand. It's a high priority, but that doesn't mean that corners are being cut.
And I think that is so important to stress, like to alleviate those concerns
yes,
that we
absolutely.
Know all parents are feeling.
Yeah.
Is there a concern or discussion around the long-term effects of the vaccine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the long-term effects of the vaccine are excellent protection against COVID, and that's the main one. You know, some people, of course, have wondered, are there going to be long-term side effects or impacts down the road that maybe we haven't anticipated? And we don't think that that's the case. There's really no scientific reason to believe that that's the case. The vaccine is actually active in your body for a very short amount of time. It's only really there for a few days while your body makes the immune reaction, and then the components of the vaccine disappear. So it's not staying in your body over the long term. We don't see long-term side effects from other vaccines. You know, most of the side effects we see are in the first few weeks after vaccination. There's really no scientific basis to think there would be unintended long-term consequences. And certainly from what we know from them, you know, now billions of people have been vaccinated since last year around the globe, we're not seeing that. So I think we can be pretty confident there's not going to be any surprises in that regard.
Mm-hmm. What about, so you had mentioned the assumption or the idea that maybe the vaccine is affecting boys more because of testosterone. Is there something on the side for girls that may affect infertility or fertility in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's another sort of, I guess, rumor or piece of misinformation that circulated around this vaccine, is that there might be some long-term impact on fertility. And again, there's no scientific reason to think that that would be the case. We have not seen any impact on pregnancy or, you know, people that were vaccinated in pregnancy having any impact on the outcomes of those pregnancies. That's why now the vaccine is recommended for pregnant women, as they're actually at high risk. So there's really no evidence so far that it has any impact at all on people conceiving, about the health of their pregnancy. And there's no scientific reason to think that the vaccine would have any long-term impact on the fertility of girls who get vaccinated now.
Okay, that helps alleviate a lot of concerns for the future. Are there
It's an important question, right? Because that's, of course, a big concern for parents wanting to know that their young children are safe in that way.
Mm-hmm. Any other kind of rumors out there that you know of, because you have these conversations a lot, that you're hearing that you'd like to address now around the future efficacy?
I think there's a few things. You know, naturally, I think the biggest concerns we hear, you know, this vaccine was developed too quickly. It's experimental. How can we know it's safe? Well, you know, and the background is the mRNA technology has been around now for over 20 years. It was something scientists have been working on as a platform for other treatments of other diseases for a long time. And I think, to be honest, it was just, we were lucky that it was sort of ready to go when this pandemic happened, and it's provided what is a very safe and effective vaccine. So I think that's a bit of a myth that needs to be busted, that this was some sort of new technology that we didn't know anything about. That's not true. And I think part of the reason we were able to see the rapid development of a vaccine is the whole world was working on it simultaneously, because this is a global pandemic. And we do have a lot of experience with vaccines, because of course we have many vaccines for other conditions. So this isn't sort of something new that people didn't know anything about. So I think that's important. I think the other, you know, pieces of misinformation are things like, oh, you know, being vaccinated increases the risk of new variants that are going to be more deadly. And that's the opposite of that's actually true. When you have spread of the virus not contained at all by vaccination and large groups of people experiencing COVID, that's when you start to see the mutation. So really, the sooner that we can vaccinate globally, the less chance there is of seeing more variants like the Delta variant develop. So vaccines actually protect against that happening, not the other way around. There's been some talk of, you know, does being vaccinated really reduce your risk of giving other people COVID? So is it really important that I get vaccinated? And again, yes, you know, it's quite clear the data shows that if you're immunized, your chances of giving someone else COVID is much less. You know, then we're hearing this, oh, COVID isn't real. You know, no one's actually sick with this. And that's, again, just total falsehood. COVID is a very real disease. I'm sure, you know, many people in the Yukon, unfortunately, have had family members impacted by this. And what's really clear is that the vaccine is hugely protective against people getting very sick from COVID. So, you know, is it possible to still get COVID if you've been vaccinated? Yes, it is possible, but it's much less likely. And your chance of being hospitalized or becoming seriously ill is much less. So it's likely about 30 times less likely to be hospitalized with COVID if you've had the vaccine. And, you know, when you look at the graphs in Canada, they look like this. Hospitalizations in the unvaccinated and the vaccinated are, you know, parallel below. So that's, I think, also a myth that it doesn't make a difference. The numbers really show that the risk is much, much higher for people who are unvaccinated. And then I think the other myth is sort of, well, it's not a serious disease in kids, so why are we worrying about vaccinating children? And again, like I talked about at the beginning, that is also not really true. You know, kids can get much sicker. The Delta variant is more serious in terms of causing more severe illness. You know, about 1 in 100 kids will end up in hospital. And then there's all those other complications we talked about. So I think trying to only focus on pediatric deaths as an outcome is really not the right thing to be talking about. Children shouldn't die. Children certainly should not die from preventable diseases. And COVID is about to become a vaccine preventable disease. So in my view, any deaths of children from this are not acceptable. And deaths in children are also rare from all diseases. So that's why it's not a great metric really to talk about with kids, because it's such an uncommon outcome really in any condition. And it's something we should never want to see happen. So I'm really excited to see vaccine happening for children, because we want to prevent any possible bad outcomes that we can.
Absolutely. Like I think zero tolerance for bad outcomes for kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And really for anyone, right? Like we don't want to see bad outcomes for anyone. We want to give all our citizens the protection that we can. And it's, I think, very clear that the vaccines are doing an excellent job of that.
And I cannot name a community yet or that has not been affected by COVID. So
Yes.
we've definitely felt the effects of COVID in our communities. For those parents that have children that are 11 years old, and if they're turning 12 this year, so in 2021, the recommendation had been, or the exemption had been set, made. If you're 12 this year or you're turning 12 this year, you can get your dose for your Pfizer vaccine. Would you recommend the 11-year-olds get the lower pediatric dose or the higher, do the 12 to 17-year-old dose?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the evidence shows us that we see a very robust reaction to the 10 microgram dose or the pediatric dose in kids who are 11. So I think if you have an 11-year-old, you can be very confident to have them vaccinated with the pediatric dose and expect they have as robust of an immune response as they would with the higher dose. So I think there's no reason for people to delay. The other people think people sometimes wonder, what if I have a really big 11-year-old? Like, what if they look more like a 13-year-old? The vaccine is not weight-based. It's just based on how your immune system responds. And younger children have a bit more of a vigorous immune response, and that's why the 10 micrograms seems to work very well. So I think the most important thing is to get your child vaccinated as quickly as possible, especially right now with the case counts going up in the Yukon. As soon as the vaccine's available, I would really encourage parents to get their kids in there and get them vaccinated, because going into winter and just with the case counts rising, I think we are seeing the numbers increase a lot in children. So the sooner we can get that protection on board, the better.
Yes, absolutely. Is there, so we're seeing that age group or the 12 years old. Thank you for that recommendation, that clarification. Are there kids that, if they have health risks, asthma, diabetes, that they should not be getting vaccinated? Are there any categories that we should be excluding?
Yeah, great question. And that's a common thing people worry about. There's really the only contraindication to being vaccinated is having had anaphylaxis to the vaccine or a severe allergic reaction, not to previous vaccines, not to other medications, but to the COVID vaccine itself. So if you had a child that was known to have a confirmed allergy to a component of the vaccine, which would be very rare, this is not common at all. Then you should absolutely discuss that with your physician, and you could have a consultation with an allergist to determine, how to immunize your child safely. But again, this would be extraordinarily rare. And then if you say your child did have an allergic reaction to the first dose of the vaccine and you were wondering about how for them to get their second dose safely, that's again a consultation that can be done with a pediatric allergist. And most allergists are reporting to us that they've been able to successfully immunize people with their second dose. In terms of any underlying medical conditions that people have that would mean they don't want to be vaccinated, there really aren't any. And in fact, children with underlying medical conditions would be more at risk of severe COVID. So those are the very kids that we want to see be immunized. The only other vaccine exemption would be if you did get myocarditis after the first dose, then that can be a reason to consider not having the second dose. But again, that's something that you could discuss with your healthcare professional if that was to occur. But again, very, very rare. So the good thing is there's really not a lot of reasons not to be vaccinated.
Is and I'm asking this question without knowing the answer. If what is the carrier in the vaccines that causes the allergic reaction?
There's a few different chemicals. One of them is called PEG, and it's a polyethylene base that some people can have an allergy to. But again, it is extremely, extremely rare. And even some people that think they have that allergy or even that had an allergic reaction to the first dose when they've been tested, in the end, they weren't actually allergic to it. So, sometimes these things sort of happen and we're not sure exactly why. And they've been able to be successfully immunized with the second dose. So the actual allergy is very, very uncommon, but it is an agent in some chemotherapy agents and other things. So there may be people that know they have a sensitivity to that, but this is not, a common thing. And that's why it's so unusual for people to actually have a true allergy to the vaccine.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
This discussion around long COVID and long COVID in children, can you describe what that looks like in children?
Yeah, so long COVID is certainly something that we're very worried about because I think we're really just starting to understand exactly what it is and what the implications of that might be. Studies in kids have shown a varying rate of long COVID post-infection from sort of a low number of about 4% of kids being infected getting long COVID up to 15% in some studies. That number is likely high. I suspect we're going to land around 4 to 5% of kids. So again, not insignificant. You know, you think 4 or 5 out of every 100 children who gets COVID has ongoing symptoms. That's worrisome. Some of the symptoms are prolonged viral symptoms, so like prolonged headache, cough, fatigue. But then for some children, it can persist, you know, longer than a couple of months into months and months of those same symptoms, particularly fatigue, but then also some neurological symptoms like brain fog, not being able to think clearly, and really profound fatigue where people aren't able to get out of bed, aren't able to do their normal activities. And some people do have persistent shortness of breath, cough, and a lot of respiratory symptoms as well. So it's definitely something that's quite concerning. We're just, I think, starting to try to understand exactly what it is, how to treat people and support people with that illness. But again, it's just one more reason why we don't want to let COVID just spread, you know, spread untempered through our children, is some kids will get that complication. And that's, of course, not something that anybody wants to be dealing with as a child who's sick potentially for months and months.
Yeah, when you think of 4 to 15%, that's a big range of long-term effects that could, if you have young athletes, and just it could affect quality of life moving forward. That's really serious.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, not something we want to be ignoring. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any advice or any messages for parents who are hesitant or worried about the safety of the vaccines?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I would say is I fully understand why people would be hesitant. I think it's really normal to not be sure about something that's new. And I think every parent always struggles with any decision around their child's health or well-being. You know, obviously, parents love their children, and their main priority is wanting to make good decisions around their child's health. And I think it's really difficult this day and age when there's so much conflicting information in the media, online, and you can go down these rabbit holes of information that can be really, really scary. So I have a lot of empathy for parents that are maybe feeling that and are confused about what to do. I think, you know, what I would say is this vaccine has been an incredible breakthrough. It's incredibly effective. It works very well. It will be one of the main tools that brings this pandemic to a close, keeps our families and communities safe, and lets us get back to our lives. It's good to ask questions. If you're not sure, if our conversation today hasn't answered your questions, you know, reach out to your healthcare provider and bring your specific questions to them. We want to hear from you. We want to be able to have these conversations and try to help you feel confident in this decision, because I think it is the right decision for children. You know, it's important to really frame this as a disease that will soon be vaccine preventable, meaning it's something that does not need to happen to our kids. So I really encourage you to, you know, reach out if you need more information. Make sure you're getting your information from reliable sources. And hopefully this is something we can do together to keep our families safe and our communities safe.
Thank you. And I think we'll, in the show notes, we'll have a link to some sites such as Health Canada or NACI, just around the reliable sources of information.
That'd be great.
Yeah. For those families, we see a lot of families being divided around the vaccine and vaccine hesitancy. Can you provide some advice to those individuals who are having challenges, just maybe amongst peer groups, other parents at schools, school councils, where they're looking at addressing vaccine hesitancy amongst children?
Yeah, I think that's such an important question. Like, unfortunately, I appreciate that this issue has become polarizing in some groups of people. And that's really unfortunate that that's happened. And I can appreciate how stressful it is within a family or community when people have different opinions and you still care for those people and you want to be respectful and you don't want to threaten your relationship. I think what's, you know, all any of us can do is try to encourage people to get accurate information. And I think seek to understand why people are concerned. You know, I think it's understandable for people who have been traumatized by a system that hasn't always cared for them. You know we have that history in this country. We know there's a lot of systemic racism still in our healthcare system. So I can fully understand why some people may not feel safe or trust the advice that's being given. So I think exploring where those roots of doubt are coming from are important. Hearing what people have to say, understanding their lived experience is really critical. And then I think trying to offer up reliable sources of information to people, where to go, where you know, what experts are reliable. And I think that's why things like you're doing right now, you know, trying to share this information with the community, having community members talk to each other, that peer-to-peer education is so, so important, because often that's where people maybe trust more than in someone they perceive to be an authority figure. So I think it's really all of us doing our part within the communities and with for each other to try to, you know, point out reliable sources of information, maybe point out why misinformation is possible, how people that are promoting misinformation are personally benefiting from that, why it's maybe not reliable. And just remembering to be kind to each other. You know, we're not all going to agree at the end of the day. But it doesn't need to be something that creates huge rifts in our families. I think we all have to make the decisions we're comfortable with in terms of keeping our own families safe. And that may be sometimes a point of, you know, argument or disagreement. But at the end of the day, I think we want to remain respectful and try to have respectful dialogues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, because it is a challenging conversation that I think all of us are facing. I know misinformation is a big piece. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of what we're seeing on social media and the heavy influence of anti-vaxxers in the US and how much that affects our social media here. Could you just highlight where people should be going besides the ones that I've just mentioned around Health Canada and NACI? Where else should people be getting their information?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, local resources like, you know, information from the Yukon government that's being put out professionally, I think is important. I can absolutely also provide your group with some other websites that are focused more on children from some of the children's hospitals or expert groups across the country that are putting out really reliable information for families around kids. So I'm happy to provide some of those links that you could put on your website or attach to this video as well. But I think really what you're looking for is that it's coming from actual scientists and institutions. You know, there's a lot of, you know, non-reputable news sources, you know, things like these anecdotes on Facebook, like these are not reliable sources of information. So I think you're really wanting to see that it's actually coming from a vetted source and trying to, you know, look online for these resources that are actually groups of scientists that are respected, attached to institutions that are legitimate. Those are some of the sort of the starting points.
Thank you. And we will definitely share all of those links with these show notes. And just to wrap up, as a pediatrician, what aha moments have you had over the past year with our healthcare system and the strengths and weaknesses that you're seeing?
Yeah, I wish I could say I was more surprised by some of the weaknesses in our healthcare system, but I've been in pediatrics for 20 years, so nothing surprises me too much anymore. But I think, you know, unfortunately, what we've really seen is COVID has just highlighted, I think, so much of what's challenging in our healthcare system right now. And these are not new problems. You know, we have a lot of austerity in healthcare. It's been underfunded for a long time. We don't have the human health resources that we need to deliver the level of care that Canadians deserve. And I mean, I think that's very clear to people in the Yukon. We know there's many people in the Yukon that don't have a family doctor, don't have access to primary care. And we just don't have the numbers of people to serve the population here. And we've been, you know, advocating that for that as Yukon physicians for a long time. But this is, again, these things don't have easy solutions. So I think what we're learning is now, I think all Canadians are pretty aware that there's a lot of challenges in our healthcare system. You know, they've made it very clear it's a huge priority for them. At the CMA, we're advocating, you know, daily with the federal government to work with the provinces and territories to increase funding to healthcare and really to start understanding how we can deliver a better integrated, less siloed system. So I hope that we start to see some of those changes. I think Canadians value their healthcare system, perhaps now more than ever, but it also means that we need to be able to, you know, start to really look at what the issues are and present some real solutions. And the status quo is not the solution.
Yes. I listened to a podcast that you had done just recently, and you talked about healthcare versus what was it?
It's like an illness system versus a healthcare system, right? So yeah. I think, you know what, that's really, we have an illness system in Canada, right? And when people talk about universal healthcare, what they really mean is universal illness care. So hospitals covered, doctors are covered, but you know, many things aren't covered. Counseling, mental health supports, you know, often therapies like physical therapy, a dietitian, even pharmaceuticals aren't covered for many Canadians. So this is partly what really leads to the siloing of our system is people are presenting to their doctor's offices with complex problems that need a team of people to solve them. And often the other people on the team are not part of the universal healthcare bundle, which then, of course, creates big discrepancies in terms of who gets what services. So I think we have to really start having those conversations about what is health, what is wellness, what do we want that to look like? And how does what we fund and support within a public system reflect those values? And I think that's a dialogue that's really emerging. And I think, again, with COVID, more Canadians now are realizing that. And that's the transformation I'd like to see, is us to start redefining what health is and really pursuing a system that helps people be well and healthy and thriving, not just reacting to illness.
And as an Indigenous person, I would love to see a more holistic vision of healthcare service, healthcare yes. delivery within
you. Well, I think that's what's amazing, right, about this idea of two-eyed seeing, is we have so much to learn from Indigenous Canadians around that worldview and that holistic way of viewing the interaction with each other, communities, nature, the world. So I hope as we start down this path of reconciliation, we'll have more of that two-eyed seeing in our healthcare system, so we can learn from our First Nations partners and citizens about different ways of looking at the world and the way we treat each other.
Yes. And on that note, I'm going to thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate you sharing your expertise and your experience with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Have a great day.